This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
Hi folks, Bob Main here, and welcome to another episode of your weekly Handgun World podcast. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Well, let's see. I think this is episode 260. I can't be 100% sure about that, but I'm fairly sure. And this is a practical show, folks, done by a practical guy. I try to make this show useful for you and give you some ideas and things that you can use right away. Whether you're a competition shooter, whether you just carry a gun for self-protection, whether you train defensively, whether you do all three, hopefully this is going to give you something for you. My background, folks, I'm in firearms training part-time right now, but my background does not come from military or law enforcement or gunsmithing. My background is just being an everyday guy, a Yankee with a gun, and that's about it. So, this episode is about force on force. I had a chance to interview John Payne from Suarez International, and we talked about what is force on force. What is it? Why should you know it? And how can it help you? Now, I have a question to start off with to ask you. And that is, have you ever practiced force on force? And if not, why not? It's pretty easy to do. I mean, all you got to do is get a couple of airsoft guns and some paintball masks and paintball padding and stuff like that. And you know what? I mean, you could do it in your backyard with airsoft guns. And try to get a like gun to the gun that you carry. Or something, or pretty close to the gun that you carry. But why force on force? You know, that's something that you'll find a lot of argument out there. You'll find people that have different views, and some people say, well, it's not necessary, and some people say, yeah, it is necessary. You got to know it. This topic and next week's topic are going to go together very well. I'm not going to tell you about what next week's topic is, but it goes very well with the subject of force on force. Now, we're right before Christmas. This is coming out about a week and a half before Christmas in 2013. And I'd like to remind you that at handgunworld.com, you can do your Amazon shopping at my Amazon store. Thank you to all of you who have been doing it. Obviously, you guys are buying some Christmas gifts on Amazon, and you're doing it through my store, and it's quite helpful. Thank you very much, because all the proceeds, the commissions that Amazon pays out, goes to help support this show. So go to handgunworld.com, click the Amazon store page, and there's a direct link there. You can go right into my Amazon store and do your shopping, bookmark it if you don't mind. Thank you for doing that. The Shooters Club. I got some good news to announce about the Shooters Club. Ben Branham and I got together and we planned it out for 2014. We have some really cool giveaways for 2014 for Shooters Club members. All members, all active members, whether you signed up over a year ago or whether you're a new sign up, we're going to have some excellent giveaways. I mean, these are going to blow your mind, folks. We're also going to have some really good discounts available for members, for product discounts in various places. Get signed up for the Shooters Club. It's only $75 a year. I just put up a new video about a week ago. And you're going to get two short videos a month, maybe sometimes one real long instructional video. But I think you're going to really like it. So go to the Shooters Club page at handgunworld.com. And keep in mind, those of you who have been supporting us for a year, thank you. Our way of giving back, you can renew for only $50. Remember that an initial membership, $75, but you can renew for only $50. Got some more exciting stuff to talk about for the Shooters Club next week also. So make sure you listen to these two end-of-the-year podcasts. So let's get right into Force on Force with John Payne. Well, John Payne's my guest. Well, John, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Bob. I really enjoy the little sessions we have.
Yeah, me too. You're one of the most frequent guests on this on my show, and I wanted to get you on here to talk about force on force. Cool subject. At SI, we do force on force training. I don't teach it, but you do. So I think it's a good subject here late in the year as people are thinking about their 2014 training plans.
Yeah, I think you're right. Force on force is a series of courses. Of course, we have the plain force on force, and we have 0 to 5 and some team tactics and whatnot. But it gives you an opportunity to leave the square range and start working these skill sets 360 degrees.
Right. Well, I want to start off with kind of a pointed question. And it's kind of controversial, but I like controversy. I seem to have a knack for getting myself in the middle of controversy, so I got to keep my record going. And why should somebody take force on force? And before you answer that question, it's because this seems to be a controversial subject. You know, when you read the Internet Commandos postings, and even if you talk to people in person, it seems like you got half the group out there that says, absolutely, it's necessary. And then you got a bunch of other people out there that say, no, it's not necessary, and it's kind of a waste of time. Why force on force?
Well, the ones that say it's a waste of time haven't done it. And you can attend a force-on-force class, and you can make it a waste of time. It all depends on what you put in it.
But why train in force-on-force? What's the purpose of it?
The purpose on force-on-force is to test yourself. It's to test yourself against a live subject.
Okay.
A live opponent. When you go out and you train live fire on the range using some type of photogenic target, are you imagining that's a real bad guy that you're working against?
No.
Never?
Well, I shouldn't say no. Most of the time, I try to most of the time, me personally. What I was saying is I think most people forget that, and they don't try to imagine that that's a bad guy. To them, it's a stationary target that they got to put some holes in.
Well, I'm not going to, quote unquote, qualify by saying most people. And I'm not telling anybody that I think they have to go to this class or have to go to a force on force class. For me, it's something that I want to do, something that I like to do. But it's also something that lets me know where my skill sets actually are. And the reason I say it like that is when I was fairly young, we didn't have a lot of access to boxing gyms. But in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a surge of martial arts schools. And there's, a huge difference in between what we did in these quote-unquote karate schools and what they were doing in judo schools.
Right.
I've heard Gabe put it in terms of an Olympic swim coach who's never gotten wet. Who's never been in the water. He can tell you exactly what angle to thrust your hand in the water and where your body needs to be and how what degree your kick needs to go in which direction from a scientific standpoint, but he's never done it. He doesn't know how to swim. Or let me step back. Maybe he knows the techniques of swimming, but he's never done it.
Right.
And going back to the karate school, in my instance, it was a Taekwondo school. We were allowed to do the semi-contact sparring, which was fine for a game.
Right.
But you don't rise to the occasion. You rise to the level of your training.
Yeah, well,
I think that's pretty much a proven fact. I mean, and then again, I'd rather be lucky than good any day.
I would too. And speaking of rising to the level of training that you have, John, I'm going to go ahead and answer my own question and get you to comment on it. I think the reason why people should take force on force is because, let's face it, if you have to defend your life with your gun, you're not going to be defending it against a paper cardboard target. You're not going to be defending it against a piece of steel. You're not even going to be defending it against a disappearing IDPA or USPSA target. You're going to be defending your life against another human being who most likely has a weapon in their hand. Or if not, you're going to be outnumbered. And there's a whole range of scenarios. So when you're up against another human being, it's a whole different world, isn't it?
Cardboard targets don't shoot back.
Not only do cardboard targets don't shoot back, most of the time they don't move. And
if they do move, it's very predictable patterns.
And they're the same color all the time.
Well, you know, I like to bring out the targets that are... They cross gender barriers and ethnicities.
Yeah, and I wasn't talking about ethnicity when I said they're the same color all the time.
Oh, I know.
I realize that people...
I make it a point to have... I've got the one series that I get from law enforcement targets. It's an armed lady, and then armed white guy, armed Asian, armed African-American. We really represent a melting pot with our targets.
But that wasn't even what I was referring to. I was referring to when I said they're not the same color. The cardboard targets are usually either a brown target or a white target, and bad guys can be wearing all different types of clothes. I was referring to the color of their clothing. If you're in force-on-force training, you know, there's all different colors and moving targets and people that you could be shooting at moving in all kinds of different directions. They could be a shorter person. They could be a taller person. They could be a heavy person. You just never know.
And they're not just shooting back at you. Sometimes they're fighting back.
Sometimes in force on force, sometimes you're fighting against, you're outnumbered, right?
In 0 to 5 feet, yes. There are scenarios where you are outnumbered.
Yeah, I took that class. I remember. So I guess it begs the question to everybody listening to this show, do you know how to defend yourself in that situation? And that's kind of what force on force is all about, right?
Force on force is about testing your skill sets against a live, thinking, moving opponent. It's making it as real as you can and still being able to go home that evening and enjoy a good dinner.
So explain to somebody who's never taken a force on force class, what can they expect?
We have a high level of safety in force on force. All live blades, all live ammunition, all live firearms are removed from the training area. Everything that we use is made for full contact training and airsoft. Airsoft is relatively inexpensive. Now you can purchase airsoft pistols and airsoft rifles that are very, very spendy. But the ammunition itself for the airsoft is very inexpensive.
Right.
Green gas is not that expensive. Through my own trial and error, I've used the propane conversions for feeding some of my airsoft gear. And you put your own mineral oil in there with it and use it. There's no substitute for the actual green gas. The difference in quality is just amazing.
So what people can expect is you're going to be dressed in protective gear. You're going to have an airsoft pistol.
Yeah, what I suggest is a paintball mask and a sweatshirt.
Yep.
A lot of people prefer to use gloves. There's different levels of epiphanies that will be experienced in force on force. First things you'll realize is this is not the opening scene of Gunsmoke, where Matt Dillon and the bad guy are doing the old 12 noon quick draw. Because no matter how fast you think you are, force on force can be I hate to put it like this, but it's the only way I can think of to say it. If you have a big ego, force on force can chip it down a little bit.
And, you know, I think that's one of the biggest reasons why people don't take force on force, because they might be the kind of person that does have a big ego and they don't want it to be deflated. Because I know what you're talking about, John. I mean, when I took 0 to 5 feet last year with you, it was quite a humbling experience.
And what's one of the first things you realized about someone charging you? I think you and one of my other good buddies found out real quick what happens when you backpedal.
I got knocked on my keister a couple times.
You know, didn't get hurt. You know, that's one of the big things. We don't try to go out and hurt anyone. And we have a series of rules that are laid out. And it's just the way it goes. When you've got scenarios that you're putting together, and you've got good guys and you've got bad guys, you have to have a series of rules to, quote unquote, level the playing field. Because unlike a real world situation, we know in a scenario something is probably going to happen.
Right.
If I was on my way to Walgreens to pick up a prescription, I wouldn't expect to get into a gunfight there. When you are in the airsoft arena or you're on one of our training areas and you're geared up with your airsoft or your paintball mask and your mouth guard and you got a sweatshirt on and you got gloves on and you're geared up with the airsoft, you know that at some point you're going to be engaging a bad guy or you're going to be the bad guy.
Right.
And one of the most important things about being a bad guy in force on force is being a good bad guy. Which means you stick to the script. You don't game it. If you're the kind of person that always has to win, you're not going to get as much out of it.
Yeah, and it is a humbling experience when you're the guy that loses.
Well, yes, it is. And when we're doing live fire classes, and when I'm in a live fire class and I'm shooting paper targets, I never is not a good way to put it, but I don't go in with the mindset that I'm going to lose. And I think you've heard me talk about doing the after-action assessment and checking yourself. You really have to step back and say, you know what, during this after-action assessment, what if I was hit? You know, what do I do now? Where in force-on-force, I can guarantee you, you are going to get hit.
Yep.
You know, it's not a big deal. It doesn't hurt. But you know it. And, you know, who wants to get shot?
Nobody.
The ideal gunfight is the one that you're not in. And if you are in one, it's more important to not get hit than it is to hit the bad guy initially. So it can alter someone's ego a little bit.
Ooh, John, you just said something there I want to expand on. You know, you said it's more important to not get hit. You know, most training that people take, most competition matches that they go to, everything's focused on getting the hit, getting the hit, getting the hit, which I'm not saying that's not important, but how much training does a person really get on avoiding the hit, avoiding being shot?
That's one of the things that our training revolves around, is not getting hit. And that's just part of it. It's not the whole package all wrapped up in just not getting hit. You know, you have to be able to put, in this case, plastic pellets on the bad guy.
Which is...
That's only part of the equation.
And the bad guy is a live, moving person, and I'm going to stress moving, because in reality, who really stands still most of the time when you're being shot at or when you're being attacked?
Well, in this case, YouTube can be your friend. You look on YouTube, you can search actual videos of gunfights and just show me how many of those people are standing still.
Yep. So let's go back to something else you said. It's a humbling experience because I think most people find out that they're a lot slower than they normally are. When you teach force on force, John, what do you find that people are typically lacking? What's the slow part for some people?
their footwork.
Okay.
Being able to move their body offline. You see backpedaling. You see sidestepping. Getting their feet tangled up with each other. You see people that have worked their draw stroke over and over and over on the live range that will fumble their draw stroke in force on force.
Why is that?
Because they're nervous. Because somebody's actually going to be shooting back at you. You know, it's one thing to work your draw stroke in front of your mirror. It's something else entirely to work your draw stroke against a live opponent.
Yeah. Now, we're not saying that working your draw stroke in the mirror is a bad thing, because it does help you get the mechanics of it perfected. But when you get out there on force and you're in a situation where what we've talked about here for the last 15 minutes or so, and someone's shooting back at you, there's a lot of fumbling going on, isn't there?
Well, what we're talking about here, Bob, is the tools in your toolbox, okay? And the reason I put it like that is because if you went and took lessons from a boxing coach, and all you did was work the drills shadow boxing, just punching air, and they taught you all, you know, taught you three or four combinations, you know, you learned to cross, you learned to hook, you learned to jab, and you worked those over and over, but you never hit a bag, how prepared are you to actually throw a punch?
Probably not very prepared.
Okay, and that's what I wanted to get hit on with the martial arts school. When we sparred in these karate schools, it was usually either a light or half-speed contact. And so at the end of the day, I was left wondering, you know, what could I actually do? You know, it was very difficult to go full speed, full contact, without somebody being injured.
Right.
And that's how some myths were created, with the, you know, the one punch kill, one kick kill kind of thing. And now that we watch the mixed martial arts tournaments, and before that, even like Sabaki, you see that the human body is very resilient.
Yes, it is.
And that one punch knockout, that one kick knockout, doesn't happen a whole lot. And what caught my attention early on, probably around 1987, 1988, was watching these judo players. And I thought, man, these guys have more on the ball than we do. And the reason is because they were able to get out there on the mat, and they were able to go full speed, full strength. They knew exactly what their capabilities were.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that you mentioned that there's not a lot of one-punch knockouts or one-kick knockouts. It's kind of like the same thing with firearms. There's not really a lot of one-shot kills either, or one-shot stops.
You know, that was, I guess, back in the 80s and late 80s, everything revolved around one-shot stop. You know, what was the best handgun caliber, and you know, there was the whole 9mm versus 45, and then we threw the 40 in the mix, and then you had the 37 Magnum with the 125 grain hollow point, and that was just the best thing since store-bought sliced white bread. But as technology continued to evolve and we got more and more information, we discovered that, well, most handgun rounds are pretty anemic.
They suck.
That's one way of putting it. That's one way of putting it. And so the idea of that fast draw and getting that first hit on target and the bad guy going down, it's not necessarily reality.
It happens in Lethal Weapon.
That was a really fun movie.
But yeah, you know, and I think when your opponent is moving, when the guy shooting back at you is moving, it's not easy to place that round in the area that's going to create a stop. It's not easy to do, which, let me ask you this, John. Do you find when people come to a force-on-force class, they understand the need for capacity?
Yeah, that's been touched on quite a bit. There's been several students that carried single-stack pistols before they attended force-on-force, that after force-on-force, by their own decision, they decided that they wanted something with more capacity.
Now, why is that?
Because nobody ever got too upset having too many BBs.
Well, I bet they do a lot of missing.
Sometimes there's missing. Sometimes, that they get on that trigger and they're so fast on that trigger that three or four rounds, they don't know if they shot four rounds. They don't know if they shot 10.
This is why the gun safety rule of knowing your target and what is beyond it is also so important.
Yeah, but there's all kinds of things that cross into the realm of force on force, where you learn things that you can only learn by getting your hands dirty.
Yeah, I would suggest to people listening to this, if you have physical limitations, no matter what they are, I don't care what they are, I think you still need to take a force-on-force class and just do the best you can with it, because if you're going to carry that gun in self-defense and you got a physical limitation, what happens if you're put into a physically demanding situation? What are you going to do? And I think people need to come and figure out exactly what their limits are and how they can perform in a physically demanding situation. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly. And not only that, but we also take and look at, if you have physical limitations, I don't dwell on what you can't do. We work what you can do.
That's good. That's good.
And with 0 to 5, it's so much more than just shooting. It covers, a bit of close range shooting. There's some work against the knife. There's some work from the ground. There's disarms. And one of the other things I want to really drill home is this is not something where I give you 50 different things to work on in 16 hours. We take things that are known to work, and we work them over and over. It's not something that you would see in Lethal Weapon. You're not going to be at the Christmas tree yard diving, rolling, and all that kind of stuff.
Let's get back to fumbling the draw stroke for a minute. Fumbling the draw, period. Is there any certain carry methods that you find that work better for people when taking a force-on-force class?
Well, I'm a strong proponent of appendix carry. And you find that appendix carry comes in very handy. It's so versatile because we'll be in awkward positions, awkward postures. You may find yourself fighting from the ground. If you recall in the force-on-force class that you were in, we had a guy that was very adamant about, the 4 o'clock carry.
Right.
And until he ended up on his back and was fending off the aggressor and couldn't get to his airsoft pistol.
If I remember correctly, he got to it, but it just took way too long.
It took a long time.
Yeah.
It was also a force-on-force class that we had one of the only pebbles in Southeast Texas get wedged into someone's SERPA holster that effectively rendered that holster not only inoperable, but locked the gun into the holster.
Blackhawk SERPA holster, it locked the gun inside of it?
It locked it inside of it. I had to use some hand tools to get it out.
So a force-on-force class lets you also test your gear to the ultimate level, and you'll be able to figure out what's going to work for you. Also to help you test your carry methods and what's going to be the best against a live opponent. I'm a big believer in appendix carry, too. And it really comes in very advantageous when you take force-on-force, which I think is probably some of the most realistic training that you can get for a real gunfight. I noticed the people that carried appendix were just so much quicker than the people carrying behind the hip.
Yes, it is. It's a very efficient draw stroke from appendix, especially when you have worked it to where it's become second nature. That even some of my folks that have worked it before found themselves getting the biggest issue that I saw with draw strokes and force on force is getting tangled up in your cover garment.
That happened to me a couple times.
So that's one of the things that happens. There's drills we work where the good guy jams the draw stroke of the bad guy.
Yep.
There's just things that you can do in force on force that you cannot do anywhere else. And, you know, we use airsoft, we use red guns, blue guns, orange guns. It's just a real eye-opening experience. You know, the very first course that I took with Swords International was active shooter terrorist interdiction. And that class was probably three-quarters force on force. And another thing people really don't tend to understand or grasp until they're baptized in the situation is how fast all this is.
Yeah, I was surprised by that. I got to say, I could not believe the speed at which everything can be over. I mean, it can be over just like lightning quick. You don't even realize that. I mean, you barely realize that the fight started. Now it's over.
Exactly. Then when you have someone like my assistant, Cullen, I mean, his regular speed, I mean, he's almost, I don't want to inflate his ego too much, but he's doggone fast. You know, we were doing the what I call the Marshall Dillon drills. It's also called the suicide drill, where you sit there and you've got your opponent at a set distance, and on command you draw and see who's faster. And end up having to have one of the guys go from a low ready position so they could keep up with him.
Wow.
But that's another thing they find out is, well, even if I'm a half second faster on my draw stroke and I get that first round off, but, you know, in that half second, the opponent shoots as well and you both get hit, who won?
Yeah, that's a good point. Who won if you both get hit? And even if you're a half a second faster and you get the first round off, there's no guarantee that first round is going to stop your attacker.
No guarantee at all. But once again, I go back to it's more important not to get hit than it is to get that first shot off.
Right, exactly. So a fast, lightning quick draw stroke, if you're getting shot, is not really all that important, is it?
Well, it's not going to be what decides whether you go home or not. Is having a quick draw stroke important? Yeah, I think it is. Once again, it's another tool in that toolbox. But I find that in the distances we're talking about, in the realm of the 0-5 fight, your dynamic movement and your gun handling skills are much more important than lightning speed or accuracy, for that matter. And when I say accuracy, I'm talking about the guys that will sit there at 5 yards and shoot groups the size of a dime all day long. That, hey, there's nothing wrong with that. It's good to have that skill set. But in the realm of the reactive gunfight, more than likely, that's not going to be possible.
You mean one-inch groups? Isn't that all you need?
It's nice to have. But once again, you know, I love to fish, Bob. I don't think I ever go out in a boat with just one lure.
Ah, good analogy. That's a good analogy. That's a very good analogy. I mean, you mind if I borrow that one from you from time to time?
I don't mind at all. And I did make that one up. If I use somebody else's, I'll tell you. But that one's mine because, you know, people that really know me know that I love to fish. And they call it fishing for a reason. If I went out and I caught fish every single time and loaded up that cooler with fish, it would be catching, not fishing.
Very good point. And the same is true with using a gun to defend your life. But I got a bone to pick with you.
Well, pick it.
All this appendix carry talk. I mean, I can't believe you teach something where a person could sweep themselves when they're drawing.
Well, you know what? No matter which way I carry, you know, I don't carry appendix when I'm in uniform. I have, you know, a right-handed holster. I sweep the seat of my car to my get in it. Every time I place the pistol in the holster, at some point or another, that holster is pointed down the side of my leg. I think that some things can be taken to an extreme that just begin to be silly.
And I was making a silly comment earlier because I just can't help myself. I have to kind of fire back at people that literally tell people not to appendix carry because it's incredibly dangerous. And, you know, they make it sound like you're really putting your life in some serious jeopardy if you carry the gun in the appendix position. And
what, Bob? There's probably people out there that don't need an appendix carry. There's people out there that don't need to drive a powerful vehicle. There's people that don't need to have sharp objects. There's people that don't need to have big dogs. And that's okay. Not everybody's the same.
No, it's true.
But when you're dealing with the art of the gun, we're talking about life or death situations. And I want the most effective tools that I can have available to me. You know, I have to follow the rules and regulations set forth by the people that I work for on how I carry on duty, and I work within those constraints. When I'm carrying off duty, it's how I want to carry. It's what I feel like benefits me the best. Now, if someone thinks that appendix carry does not benefit them, by all means, don't do it.
I agree. I just want to encourage people to keep an open mind. Don't listen to anybody tell you that you shouldn't do something and that it's their opinion that you shouldn't do it. You know, try it for yourself. Have an open mind. Go out to a class. Go to a range or something and train. Train more than once from the appendix position. Try behind the hip. You know, try whatever it is that you like, but give it some serious training time or practice time before you listen to somebody that says, oh, you shouldn't do that.
I agree, Bob. I think the Air Force should make the decision for themselves. And the best decision to make is an informed, educated decision.
Yeah. It's kind of like the people – I don't want to derail this conversation too much, but it's kind of like the open carry versus concealed carry argument. You know, people ought to have a choice. They ought to have a choice to do whichever one that they want to do. And we could argue till next year about which one's better and still not solve the argument. But – you know, you do have the people. I'm every week I do this show, I try to get people to decide things, be thinkers for themselves, and not just accept what everybody tells them.
And I think that's very important. I mean, you know, I'm all about personal responsibility. No one is responsible for you but you. So any decision that I make, I hope that it's an informed and educated decision. I really don't like knee-jerk decisions. And like I said, if someone doesn't like it, they don't want to carry that way, then by all means, don't. But I find it to be very effective. I find it to be very versatile. I find it fits me. It works for me.
Yep. Now, question. Let's get back to force on force. What do people need to bring to a force on force class? Oh, music.
What do they need to bring to a force on force class?
Yeah.
An open mind. The ego can stay at home. Good footwear. Comfortable clothing. Good, solid carry gear, an airsoft replica of their carry pistol, green gas, BBs, face protection, meaning the paintball mask. I would recommend having a mouth guard, a good sweatshirt, some gloves if you feel like you're going to need them, once again, an open mind.
I would also say it's not a class for a beginner.
0 to 5 is a unique class. You know, it's listed as CRG 5. It's one of our advanced classes. If you're meaning a beginner, that someone has never carried a firearm or has just bought their first firearm, then I would agree. If it's someone that's only had basic pistol class, or you know, training in fundamentals, meaning marksmanship fundamentals and draw stroke, this class is not going to hurt them one bit. That's another neat thing about 0-5 is what you can do in the realm of force-on-force without causing injury. You know, some of the classes, and you know because you've taught alongside me, you've taught your own classes, when you get done teaching a two-day class, when it's all said and done, everything's packed up, and you're heading back to your house, you suddenly realize how physically and mentally drained you are.
The next morning, I realize it.
And one of the reasons for that is because, you know, and you've seen me do it. I watch everybody as closely as possible. Some of the students have made comments about, well, how did he see that? It's because I'm watching. You know, having to constantly be on point after 2 days, that is draining. In force-on-force, you don't have some of that stress because you're dealing with airsoft pistols and you're wearing safety gear.
Yep. Yeah, I think people need to realize that it's the kind of experience going to a force-on-force class that is it literally change your thinking about almost everything.
You'll find out that perfect two-handed grip you've been working for the past year, you may not get it.
Oh, really? Wow.
You'd be surprised how much it turns into, you know, one-handed shooting. I think there's a reason why the people that, you know, invented the handgun called it a handgun and not a hands gun. You'll be surprised at how many times you get hit in the hands.
Oh, man, I was shocked. I got hit in the hands a lot. Now, you know what? I know why that is, but why don't you explain to listeners, since you teach it, why is it people get hit in the hands a lot?
Well, I think that there's multiple reasons for it. One of the reasons is because, you know, being humans and having our eyes in the front of our head, we tend to focus on the threat. And when you've got a bad guy pointing a gun at you, that gun is the threat. The other reason is because when you've got two guys duking it out with airsoft pistols, the airsoft pistol and their hands are what's between you and them.
Yep. I'm definitely bringing gloves to the next class.
And, you know, I've got some marks on my fingers where I've gotten nailed before. But it really drives home the importance of being able to use your pistol with either hand.
Right. Well, you mentioned not getting the perfect grip. Happens all the time in force-on-force, especially because you're under stress, you're in an extreme hurry, you're on the move. That's why a pistol that you cannot shoot properly and effectively with a one-handed grip and sometimes with a weak one-handed grip, I don't think it's a pistol you should be carrying. And, you know, a lot of it's going to depend on the person.
It depends on the person. The pistol that you choose is an individual choice.
Right.
Once again, the best decision you can make is an educated decision. But you and I both saw a very good student in a regular close-range gunfighting class that failed to engage the grip safety on his XD.
That's right.
And at first, he didn't know what the problem was. So that has caused a problem. That was in a live fire class. You know, I have witnessed in this exact same class a guy that's been carrying a 1911 for years that during force on force, he missed his thumb safety. That was rather interesting, especially to me as someone that you know, for years I carried a 1911 as my duty pistol. I didn't have that problem. But going back to leaving the ego behind, I began thinking after seeing that, well, you know what? It has not happened to me, but I'm not so bold to say that it could not happen to me.
Right. Well, we call them reactive gunfights because that's what we're doing. We're reacting to the actions of a bad guy. The bad guy typically gets to act first. The bad guy usually gets to dictate the terms of the fight. At least in the beginning, he does. And that's what I think a lot of people fail to realize.
Yeah, you're going back talking about the capacity of your handgun. One lady, her comments were, in some scenarios, you find yourself with an empty gun real fast.
Yep.
And that that doesn't mean that she would never carry a J-frame again or an 8-shot 45, but now she would do so with the full personal understanding that she might run out of ammo when the doo-doo hits the fan. And I thought that was a profound statement.
Did she make that comment in a force-on-force class?
She made it in a review of force-on-force class.
Okay.
And I thought that was profound. You know, she's not saying that she would never carry a J-frame again, but now if she carries one, with the full understanding that, you know, she might run out of ammo during a bad situation, and she is now far more committed to carrying spare magazines or speed loaders or speed strips if she's going to carry something like that.
I bet it happened to her in force-on-force class. She probably ran out of ammo, right?
That's what she's saying.
What was she using in Force on Force? Was she using an airsoft?
I wasn't present for that. I was just reading one of the reviews here a while back, and that's something that really caught my attention.
Probably what she was using was a high capacity. Obviously, she was using an airsoft that had a lot of pellets and probably still running out or running a lot lower than she thought. And then she started comparing that to what she carries on a daily basis, and the lights came on.
Yeah, and just for the mentality of that, I mean, you've been in force on force with us. You've been in 05, and these airsoft pistols, the Glock replicas, they carry more than 17 BBs in that airsoft magazine.
Yep.
You know, I think you can fit up to like 20 or 24 of them in there. Did you see anybody that were just loading theirs to 15 or 17, or were they loading them all the way up?
Yeah, the people that were there from California. No, I'm just joking.
You know, it's like, hey, why don't you download that by about 10 BBs? Oh, no, I'll go ahead and load it up.
Yeah. But, you know, but the thing is in New York, the politicians know better, and they know that all anybody needs is 7.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about me going to New York.
But back to the ammo capacity, it does make the lights come on, you know, taking force on force. And I'm convinced this because a lot of people that think that they can perform well, when they get there, they realize they're not making the hits that they want to make, and they got to have that ammo capacity.
Or it doesn't feel as natural as they thought it would. You'll have guys that have trained on the dynamic movement of moving to all directions off the face of the clock that suddenly, when pressed by an aggressor, began backpedaling. And nothing drives a point home like ending up on your keister when you've been, you know, try to backpedal. And plus, you can take the slowest sprinter that you have in class and have them line up with someone trying to run backwards, and even the slow sprinter is going to move faster than someone trying to run backwards.
Yep. Wouldn't you just love to one time get Dianne Feinstein and Joe Biden and have them put the pads on and an airsoft pistol and then ask them when the course is over how many rounds you need?
No. No, I really wouldn't want to be
trying to visualize that. I'm trying to visualize that, and then I'm thinking, Bob, why did you say that? Actually, you know, because I think some people would.
That's a bad visual feel there, Bob. Thank you for the nightmare.
I was making a point, though. I mean,
I get your point. By all means, I get your point, but no, they, you know, I'm perfectly happy with them staying exactly where they are.
The thing I want people to think about, and you're in law enforcement, you can probably speak to this. You know, how many police departments issue their officers an 8 or a 9 round pistol?
Probably very few now. You know, back in the day when your choice was a 6-shot revolver or a single stack 1911, there were some progressive places that did issue the 1911. that was progressive at the time.
At the time.
At the time. And, you know, I still, I, even though I consider it to be almost an antique, there's a lot of love in my heart for the design of the 1911. It's kind of hard for me to put into words, but it just, when you've got a quality piece in your hand like that, that's well made, it's a work of art. And that's all fine and good. You know, I didn't invent this saying, but, you know, a lot of times it's not the arrow, it's the end in that makes the difference.
Well, and I have a lot of admiration for the 1911 pistol as well, especially the triggers. The triggers are phenomenal. I mean, they're just, you know, probably the best trigger you can get in a handgun still today. And I'm not trying to pick on 1911s with some of my comments, but I think we find that the self-defense dynamics, they have evolved, they have changed. This is not 1968. It's not even 1982. This is almost 2014, and things have become quite different than they were 50, 60, even 100 years ago.
It's true. It's true. And, you know, the 1911 can still be a very effective sidearm. Very effective. But it's kind of like my Jeep, Bob. You know, I really enjoy my Jeep. I like driving it on my days off. I like going off-road with it. But it's not my daily driver. I drive it on you know, on my off-duty time and primarily on weekends. But my Jeep would not be the vehicle that I would choose to drive across the country. It wouldn't be comfortable. It doesn't manage its gasoline very well. I can't pass a gas station without kind of leaning that direction, wanting to go in. You know, there are better vehicles for that role of a daily driver or for a long distance trip. The 1911 can be a very effective personal defense firearm. It can be an effective duty gun, but I myself am more comfortable with something that has a higher capacity. It doesn't rely on a sear locking safety and doesn't rely on a grip safety. That's my personal choice. I don't look down at anybody that carries a 1911. I still have one in my inventory, but I think that there are tools available now that are just a little more versatile.
So back to force-on-force classes or force-on-force training. What kind of, give us an example of some scenarios that people can expect to be in.
Well, I don't want to give too much away in that regards, but you can expect to work the drill to see exactly how fast your draw stroke is against a live opponent. You can expect to have a scenario where you are having to work against a drawn gun. That you will have a scenario where you'll have to deal with a knife pointed at you, that you will work scenarios where you have been, for whatever reason, you've ended up on the ground, and you're trying to keep the aggressor off of you while accessing your sidearm, or while you have someone that's actually on top of you trying to reverse that situation where you can better your position and improve your odds.
Good, good. Earlier in this interview, you talked about also teaching working against somebody with a knife. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, yes, I can. One of the things that I learned early on when I first began studying different martial arts is how woefully ineffective a lot of the knife defense was taught, or the knife disarms. What we work is fairly simple. It's not something that you would see on Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. But it revolves around the reality of that edged weapon. There are times in different situations where you're trying to create space, but when you're inside that 0 to 5 realm, sometimes trying to create space is going to put you in a more dangerous situation. Sometimes you have to take that 0 to 5 space and you have to own it.
Yep, that's right.
And that's what 0 to 5 gunfighting is about. It's about being in the hole, and instead of trying to fight your way out, you decide to own the hole.
Right. Now, the reason I brought up the knife issue is because there seems to be a lot of people that buy into the absolute argument of don't bring a knife to a gunfight, and they really believe that a knife is incredibly inferior to a gun, and most of us don't know that we're going to get into a gunfight. Most civilians that carry a gun every day don't really know, don't even expect to get into a gunfight, but furthermore, they probably don't expect to get into a knife fight. So talk about what do you see in force on force at close distances when one has a knife and the other has a gun?
Well, I can tell you, if you try to rely on your fast draw, it's going to be an eye-opener for you, number one. Number two, the people that think that the gun trumps the knife every time have never seen the results of a knife attack. People talk about the knife fight. I hope that I am never in a knife fight and would never knowingly enter a knife fight. I consider my knife training to be limited at best, and I would hate to come up against someone that is trained even half as well as I am with an edged weapon. Number two, knives do not malfunction. They do not run out of ammo.
You don't have to reload them.
Yeah, exactly. There is no reloading an edged weapon. And while there is no ballistic effect, pretty much whatever that knife touches, it gets to keep.
Yep, knives don't. You don't have to maintain magazines. You don't have to have a speed loader for a knife.
And so one of the things, I do not concentrate on a quote-unquote knife fight or what I consider to be a duel. Dueling with a knife is a completely different animal. I have done some training dueling with buoys and whatnot in it, and that is a lot of fun. I don't use live blades, okay. But it's a lot of fun. It's part of our American culture. I think the buoy is a timeless edged weapon, but the idea of actually getting into a knife duel is a completely different animal. And for those that have the idea that the bad guy with a knife is going to show you and brandish the knife before executing an attack, again, they've never been to the scene of where a knife attack occurred.
And I've heard you say this before in a class. Some people like to rely on their little binky, and that little binky is the gun in their holster. And they think
it's the magic talisman that protects them from all harm. It's kind of like that lucky rabbit's foot.
Right. And I think when people get into force on force, they realize the gun is not always the answer to every problem.
No, it is not. And sometimes the gun can create more problems than it was intended to solve.
Yep. Yep, good stuff. This is good stuff, John.
One of the things that really rings true to me in force on force and working these skill sets is that everything that is old is new again. And that was quoted from Peter Allen. I'm not sure who Peter Allen was, but I wanted to make sure that if I was going to use a quote, I would say who initially came up with it. And that's going back to the martial arts analogy. A lot of this stuff is not new. What is new is our understanding of it.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the reasons why it's new is I think today we live in a culture where for many, many, many years we've largely been insulated from tragic events and from violence and attacks, and a lot of people just don't see the need to learn some of this stuff. But I think a lot more people are waking up And I think some of that insulated bubble that they've been living in is starting to show some cracks, and they're realizing what actually is out there and could happen out there.
Yeah, I think you're right with that, Bob. And one of the neat things about Force on Force is this is your opportunity to work these skill sets, again, in a environment where you're going to feel that stress. And you're going to have all these different things happening at one time. And it's just not as clean and pretty as it is in your daydreams.
Yep. That's exactly right.
So I really don't think anyone can say they are a true student of the martial gun unless they seek out this type of environment where they can test what they trained.
Or like we said earlier, where you can test your capabilities and understand your limitations.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And, you know, we seek to test everything that we do. You know, it's not good enough that it looks good on paper, it sounds good, and this is what we're going to do because it sounds good or it looks good. It's about what actually works in a hostile environment.
Yep. Well, John, I think
this
is a pretty good stopping point. We've been going on for quite a while. I think we did a pretty good job of getting our point across about Force on Force. I like to give everybody who comes on the last word and give them the last minute or two. So what other comments do you have about Force on Force?
Well, we're having CRG 5, 0 to 5 feet gunfighting, March 8th and 9th in Orange, Texas. The enrollments for this class are already looking very strong. I expect to have 15 to 20 students in this class. This class is probably 95% force on force. There is some live fire in the course. That once again, while we're doing the actual force on force training, we're very, very careful and very adamant that once again, only you responsible for you. You check yourself, you check your buddy, he checks you. So there is no live blades, no live ammo, and no live weapons in the training area when we're doing the force on force. The venue that we have for this is just ideal. You've trained on this bay that we're using. The grass is so thick, it's like wall-to-wall carpet.
It is nice.
We're doing it in an outstanding time of the year when the weather is usually just wonderful. You're talking temperatures in the upper 60s and lower 70s. You know, it's all about integrating the pistol into the fight in the 0 to 5 feet realm. This is where we really start to find yourself in a situation where you find out what you're capable of, what you're not capable of, what you really need to work on. Whether it be you know your gun handling skills, whether it be your footwork, whether it be your fitness, all of these things go together to make someone a well-rounded fighter. You know, we train to do these things so that out in the world, you know, you don't have to.
Well, out in the world when a fight starts is not the time to begin your training.
No, it's also the wrong time to make a decision about what you're going to do.
Yeah. Good. Thank you, John. Appreciate you coming on and talking about this.
Thank you, Bob. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a good conversation, as always.
I had never, up to this point, I don't think I did a show on Force, so this was good.
Hey, and you're going to try to make it out for this, aren't you?
Yep. About 85 to 90% sure.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of good information. You know, it's just one of those things that we can really, we can go out and have a good time and, you know, we play hard, but you know, it's within reason and, it's always a good time.
Yeah, it is. Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Bob.
Take care. Thank you, John. That was good stuff. Hopefully we got you thinking about how you train, how you practice, and how you're going to use your handgun. Force on force. I plan on taking at least one force on force course in 2014. Most likely it's going to be John Payne's 0 to 5 feet pistol gunfighting. I have to confirm that into my calendar. My full-time employer actually might have an event for me to go to, a week-long event for me to go to during that time frame. But I'm not sure if I'm going to have to attend that or not. 50-50 chance whether I have to do that. If I miss that one, I will get to another force-on-force class somewhere. But 0 to 5 feet pistol gunfighting is an excellent course. I have taken it once. Matter of fact, I did a podcast review on it when I was driving home. So I think you'll enjoy that. Also, I forgot to mention something about the Shooters Club. You can also sign up for $8 a month. So I understand that money for some of you are a little bit tight. You can also sign up on the Shooters Club for $8 per month. You'll see that when you go to the Shooters Club page at handgunworld.com. If you want to voicemail me comments or some topics and things like that, you can always send me a voicemail, 210-646-1727. I will put a couple voicemails on next week's show. I've received a few voicemails from listeners. Thank you very much. You'll be on next week's show. 210-646-1727 or go to handgunworld.com. Go down to the lower right-hand side of the page and you'll see a big call me button. You can also just click the call me button and it will be an automated system that'll link up your phone with my voicemail. And I will put you on the show. If you want to get email updates, by the way, a lot of you have been using the email update feature. You can get emailed every time I put out a new show. And you can sign up for that at handgunworld.com also. Last but not least, I want to let you know, I am putting together a training event. Two of them, actually. I'm putting one together with Glenn Tate. Glenn Tate, the author of the book series, 299 Days. Get ready, listeners, in the Pacific Northwest. There's a very good chance Ben Branham and I are going to be coming up there in the summertime with Glenn Tate to do some training. So that, be listening to the show and watching my Facebook page for that. And also, Mr. John Hottaway and myself, we're going to put together an event in Arkansas. That's coming together nicely. And we'll be confirming some details shortly. Once all of this is confirmed, I'll be able to go ahead and announce it. But I think you guys are going to really like these two training events. With all that said, folks, thanks for listening to another episode of the Handgun World Podcast. I'm Bob Main. The reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Remember that the loudest sound a shooter hears is a bang when he's expecting a click, or a click when he's expecting a bang. Shoot straight, shoot safe. Talk to you next week. Have a Merry Christmas. Bye-bye.